The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, December 7th, the What's Elf on the Shelf edition. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, a journalist and podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am mom to Henry, who is 16, Teddy, who is 14, and my stepdaughter, Lily, who is 17.
And I am Carvel Wallace, a writer and podcaster out in Oakland, California, and I am the father to Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 14.
And I'm Catherine Goldstein, a contributing editor to Slate, and the mom to Asher, who is almost 2.5.
Now, Gabriel Roth is feeling under the weather this week, but he'll be back next time. Feel better, Gabe. Today, we'll be taking listener questions about dealing with estranged parents and whether following the rules is limiting a child's potential career path. But first, it's time for triumphs and fails. Carvel, what have you got for us?
Well, I know the last time we had all triumphs and that made us uncomfortable, but I as much as I tried to fuck up my parenting this week, I couldn't do it. It just kept working out. So I have another triumph, which is that we have this tradition in our family every year of we drive north to this Christmas tree farm, which is like 2 hours north of here, which is way longer than it needs to be, and then we cut down a tree. And then we spend the whole day at this like winter wonderland and we get like peppermint bark and we pick out every year these kids pick out new ornaments and then we put the tree on the top of the car and then we drive back and we stop for burgers on the way back and then I drop all the kids off and then me and my two kids go home and we set up the tree. That's what we do every year. And it has turned into like a little bit of a thing where other kids will join in. So we have this one kid who really doesn't really even interact with our family at all, except she always goes with us to get this Christmas tree, which is so random. And now she's now a 10th grader. So she's really in full, but we've been doing this ever since she was like in elementary school. But she's at full teenage mode. Anyway, we did this thing and we went to get the Christmas tree and it was just, the whole thing was a victory. There wasn't one particular thing that happened. It was just such an incredibly good day. And we went through all the phases. We listened to Christmas music the whole way up. And then the kids complain about the Christmas music and they keep wanting to put on like Trap. And I'm like, we're not listening to Trap today. This is a Christmas thing. There's not going to be any like Lil Pump or whatever it is you want to listen to. That's not happening. You know what I mean? Like we're doing the Christmas thing. We're going to Motown Christmas. And that's what this is. And shut up and be quiet back there and get in the fucking Christmas spirit. Goddammit. And we play this whole thing and everyone laughs. And it's all fun. And then we get there and we did it all. And then they pick out ornaments and it takes them forever to pick out ornaments. And they fight over who's going to get what ornament and all this stuff. And we just did it. We did the whole thing. We brought the tree back. We set it up. The kids decorated. But the thing that made this one special was that the kids really were in charge of decorating the tree. Like me and Joe just kind of sat down and watched them do it. And it was this weird rite of passage where Ezra actually ended up putting instead of a star, we have a dove that we put on top of the tree. Ezra ended up putting the dove on top of the tree himself. He climbed up on the ladder and he was the one that anointed the tree with this final thing. When I tell you that I started to cry inside when I saw this, because it suddenly just occurred to me, and this is the thing about these family traditions, is you see your kids' progress over time. And we have these ornaments that have pictures of them from when they were babies, you know, like these little tiny ornaments. And then we have little ornaments that it's like Ezra's third Christmas, George's second Christmas, you know. And we just get to see these things every year. And something about watching them put together the tree themselves and choose where the lights were going to go and take out all the ornaments and hang them up. And then finally watching Ezra climb the ladder and put the dove on top. It really blew my mind. I just became really grateful and appreciative for everything that has happened and how our kids are here. And it was a victory. I'm sorry. I tried to fuck it up and I couldn't do it. It was just too good.
Carvel, your life is turning into one of those Hallmark Christmas movies. That's what's happening right now.
Yeah, I know. It's a little frightening. I'm way out of my element here.
I actually find that story so moving, Carvel, being at the beginning of my parenting journey, the idea of seeing them sort of take to the tradition and also the fact that they're teenagers and aren't treating it sort of like it's a silly kid thing or in a cynical way, just and we're really able to enjoy it. And then the whole image of Ezra putting the dove on the top is so cool. So that sounds totally amazing, like really exciting start to the holiday season.
Now, Catherine, yeah. Can you counter that with some sort of horrible fail for us?
Well... I do have a fail. I don't know. You'll have to tell me if it's as terrible as That Is Wonderful. But here's my fail. So my son is almost 2.5, and he's definitely now in that age where he's obsessed with toys. And he really likes new toys, and it's the novelty is really important. I don't know if that ever wears off or if this is a phase, but and he's really into vehicles and cars, and you know, he loves the little plastic cars you get at drugstores, et cetera, et cetera. So my husband and I are really not on the same page about how many toys we should be buying him and on for what reasons and on what occasions. So I feel like when we lived in Cambridge for a while, I was really hesitant to get more toys because we were going to move. And I think I kind of overdid it with like the toy ban or whatever. And then we came back to New York, and he's all of a sudden, my husband, I felt like, was going out every weekend with him to like buy a toy. And I really felt like that was excessive. And my husband kind of saw it as like, it's just like a fun activity. Like you could get him cars at a toy store or like a bodega or whatever. And it was like a good distraction, a good new thing. But I just really started to worry he's going to get spoiled. Like he's not showing signs of being spoiled, but I just felt like a toy for no reason every weekend seemed really like a lot. And my husband feels like it's not a lot. And so we're at a like bit of a stalemate, and now anytime buying toys comes up, it's this like sort of tense conversation. And then we're also in a dynamic where I'll occasionally see toys like we could order online that I think he'd really like that aren't just like stupid drugstore plastic stuff that's going to break, but I won't order it because I'm like, oh, well, Travis will be getting him more toys anyway. And then Travis gets to be the fun parent who's always getting the toys. So it's basically like, yes. I feel like I'm having to be like this, a really, like really grinchy about it. And, but to sort of counteract the enthusiasm Travis has. And I feel like we're on the same page about a lot of things, but toys, whenever it comes up now, is like a tense topic in our home. So I feel like that is a fail. I would, I welcome your counsel.
Oof, well, I remember, you know, having a similar situation. I was and still am the sort of perpetual buyer of things that my kids want. I'm not going to lie about that. It's true. They're not spoiled, though. I mean, I don't think anybody would think that if they met them. They're very appreciative of all their stuff they have. They're very polite. They're normal kids. But I mean, there was a point when they were really little where, like, you know, just couldn't. Like even just going and buying something for a couple bucks every weekend would have just been like not super affordable. So I remember just like coming up with a system where we would hide a bunch of stuff, like just only have a certain amount of toys available at all times and then sort of rotate the toys so they kind of felt new to the kids, you know. So we'd have like separating toys into a bunch of boxes, putting them in sort of storage bins and putting some of the bins in like a closet and then like switching out all the bins on this little like rack system we had so that on a Saturday morning, they'd have like different stuff to play with that maybe felt new to them a little bit. But I don't know. I mean, this sounds like, you know, a philosophy thing that might be a little tougher to deal with than just that. I don't know. What do you think, Carvel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's two issues here, right? One is like that you don't like the amount of toy purchasing that has become a part of your life. And the second issue is that from a purely strategic perspective, that puts you in a little bit of a corner because now you've got one person lavishing love and objects on your child and then another person, which is you, having to counter. So you've been maneuvered into this difficult position. So for the second thing, I have a much easier thing, which is that but it requires the first thing to change. Like, I don't think there's a problem with buying little toys from the bodega on a regular basis because those toys, I mean, I think there's an environmental issue with it, which is not great. But I don't think like a kid's psyche will be destroyed because those toys sort of come and go. A lot of what I remember from my own childhood, actually, I was really into Matchbox cars. That was a big part of my thing. And I had this like $2 allowance I would get every week when I was a kid. And so I would use that allowance to go to buy a Matchbox car. And I had like, it seemed like 1,000 Matchbox cars. And what does one kid need with this? Just like all this Matchbox cars, but I was into it. I really did like the acquisition, but like then, but the thing is, I would organize the ones that I really, they were top. I was a little bit OCD about it. I had like the top 12. They had names and organized in terms of awesomeness. And then the remaining ones just were like the rabble. They were just they were the masses, the unwashed masses. And these were the royal cars. And the unwashed masses, I didn't think much about them. I would give them away to friends. Friends would take them. Sometimes every once in a while, like an adult would be like, oh, we're going to donate some stuff. I'd be like, you can donate some of these because I'm just going to get more. So we kept it moving, but there were the 12 golden ones that were really important. So all that's to say that I think the thing about how many, like, I think buying little toys is a fun activity and something to do when we know it can be really boring having a kid that age. So I think it's not a problem. I think that you should look a lot at donation and how you can keep the flow, keep the sort of like feng shui of toy movement as part of the thing. That's a really key thing. But I also think that if that many toys are going to get purchased, you should see if you could do some of the toy buying so that your kid doesn't, you know, if you like finally like admit that, okay, we're going to do these little bodega trips for little cheap toys every week or so, then you need to get in on that so that your kid doesn't just associate that with.
Yeah. I need to relax and claim some of the toy buying glory for myself.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good solution. There's like a cool...
I like the bins idea, Rebecca. I've thought about that, but I haven't like actually tried to implement it. So obviously storage is an issue in a tiny New York apartment, but I think hiding stuff and then reintroducing it is totally a great idea. And also,
it's what you do with dogs, by the way, too.
Yeah. And also, lightening up, also a great idea.
I remember when my son Teddy was super into Matchbox cars, and I don't know if they still make these, but they used to have this like Matchbox car holder that you hung over a door, and it had these glass, these like plastic pouches. Mm-hmm. They're sort of like one of those shoe hanging
like the
things.
Shoe things. That's exactly what it's like.
Yes. And you would put one car in each pouch, and it held a lot. So I think the idea of having like those have the place of honor, and then he has to choose one to give to somebody else if he gets a new one. I think that's a really good idea. I mean, if this horrible habit of spoiling your child is going to continue, maybe that's a way.
I also think it's important that the toys that you're buying are these cheap toys. It's not like every week you're going out and buying like these $70 laser tag systems or anything. So it really is about the gesture and the experience more than the object, which I totally get.
Right. Yeah. And everyone knows that when you get a kid a Matchbox car, he'll be quiet for the rest of the day while you get your coffee or whatever. So
exactly right.
I get it. I totally get it. So I have a little bit of a fail this week, but it's a little more existential. My younger son, Teddy, reported that he's feeling a little bit abandoned, especially when he's at his dad's house, because his brother, who now drives and has a car and has a girlfriend, is like gone all the time. And, we live in a different sort of area of town than their dad does. And I think their dad lives in a little more of like an outside pocket of town. So when Henry wants to have friends over, like he'll do it at our house. So we just see Henry more on the weeks where I have the boys, I think, than Teddy and his dad see Henry when they're at his house for geographic reasons. And Teddy's talking about feeling abandoned. And we're sitting at the dinner table the other night, and he's like, Henry, you're just never around. And, you know, I kind of feel like I want to have a relationship with my brother. I mean, we just have each other. Like, I hear him like parroting all these things that I'm sure adults have said at some point in front of them. And then Teddy says, yeah, I don't want to be like mom with her sisters and like never talk to them.
Whoa.
Sick burn.
Yeah, ouch. Sick burn. Yeah, super ouch. And I do know this coming. My older sister and I have two sisters. My older sister and I are closer than my middle sister and I. You know, we talk somewhat, but I definitely haven't been visiting and talking to her as much in the last couple years as I had before, because in addition to my day job, we're now doing all this like podcasting stuff, and we have this business that's kind of taken off. And yeah, I used to have a closer relationship with my sister and the kids used to see her a lot, and they don't, and they have noticed. So I feel like a dick, and I'm trying to figure out some ways I can show, not tell, what being a good sibling is like in adulthood, so that my kids have something a little better to aspire to than being better than their crappy sibling mother is in this situation. So yeah.
Wow.
So yeah. Anyway, yeah.
All right.
I don't need advice. I just need acknowledgement that sucked. So thanks, guys.
That totally sucked. And it's
that totally sucked.
That's the sort of thing where you can imagine, like, maybe the kids aren't super in tune to that, and then you realize they're completely paying attention.
Totally.
Yeah, and that, you know, these small things that maybe you haven't even given it so much attention yourself and that they've noticed, like, that's a very sort of chilling reminder that your children are always watching.
Exactly. They watch. They're never not watching. They are the elf on the shelf, but in real life is what these kids are like.
I'm like the elf. Oh, what is that?
Wait,
oh,
you've never heard of Elf on the Shelf?
No,
it's
what is
the
this?
Worst. See, I'm famously a hater of Elf on the Shelf. I'm famously a hater of it. So don't get
what
me started.
Is it,
but I did just bring it up,
Carvel. I can't believe you are such a lion in the world of parenting.
He's
media
lucky.
And not know
He's
what
lucky.
This is.
Oh,
he's lucky
feel,
though. He
I feel
that
my
kids.
All right. Well, just you might as well tell
okay.
me.
Okay. An elf on a shelf is an elf that people put up around, I don't know, maybe around Thanksgiving, where
fuck?
It is watching the children.
No.
To
where
be
is this
sure.
going? What is? We are sick. We are a broken
to be
society.
Not just, it's no longer Santa's watching. The elf is there. Geez. And then when they go to sleep, they move the elf. So it's like, oh, they're in a new spot in the house. So you better watch out. They're always watching. It's kind of like this authoritarian state mentality
yep.
about good
it.
Behavior.
Kind of?
It is definitely an authoritarian state idea about good behavior. And so it essentially...
Disguised as an adorable tradition that is not a tradition because someone made it up and sold it as a product.
Yeah, and I think it's only like 10 years old. Like, it's not like a long-standing tradition.
No.
Jesus.
So people buy the elf and it just basically tell their kids they're always watching, so they better be good for the whole Christmas. And they use it as a form of mind control.
Well, that's the most horrific thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Thank you for sharing that with me.
And it's the most accurate description of Elf on the Shelf I've ever heard anyone give. So nice job with that. Nice job.
Mom and Dad and our fighting listeners who love Elf on the Shelf, I hope you'll send us your emails.
Oh, we'll get angry emails about this.
Yeah, justify yourself, please. Please. Try to make sense of this.
Yeah. I'm only here today, so I don't have to read the emails.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to get a barrage. Bring it on, Facebook messages. Bring it on.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now, getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
We'll get to listener questions in just a minute, but first, let's do a little bit of business. First, we want to tell you about another Slate show. It's TrumpCast, a quasi-daily podcast from Slate that sets out to understand the real Donald Trump. Jacob Weisberg, chairman of Slate, along with writer Virginia Heffernan and Slate chief political correspondent Jamel Bowie, will be talking to historians, psychiatrists, and other experts to help explain who this man is and why this is happening right now in the United States of America. Check out TrumpCast wherever you get your podcasts. Wherever you get your podcasts. And we want to hear from you. If you want to ask us a question on air, leave us a voicemail at 424-255-7833. It's the best way to have us respond to your questions, and we love hearing from you that way. Today on Slate Plus, our special guest host, Catherine Goldstein, weighs in on the ever-angsty topic of faith and the holiday season. To hear this segment and to get ad-free episodes of the show, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program, and it's a great way to support us. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing Mom and Dad Are Fighting and your other favorite Slate shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows and a ton of great benefits. So if you want to support Mom and Dad Are Fighting, go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, on to listener questions. Here's our first listener question. It's going to be read by our producer, Benjamin Fresh.
My mother and I are basically estranged. We exchange an email once or twice a year, usually only with very general niceties or family news. I cut off contact with her several years ago after finally coming to terms with her manipulative and emotionally abusive approach to our toxic relationship. For what it's worth, I don't think she has ever been able to acknowledge the impact of her actions on the demise of our relationship. She suffers from depression and probably other undiagnosed issues, so I do have sympathy for her, but I also know I'm healthier without her. So here's my question. My daughter Ella is now almost 2 years old. My mom knows about her, and I've shared some photos, but they have never met. I feel like I owe it to my daughter to offer some introduction to her grandmother because at some point I think she will start to ask, and I don't want her to grow up feeling like I denied her that relationship. Ella is very close with my husband's mother. I also don't feel comfortable lying to her about why we don't see my mother, but I can't figure out a way to explain it to a preschooler. To further complicate my question, my own grandmother, Mom's mom, is rapidly declining, and it's likely I will need to make a decision about attending her funeral in the coming months. It would be the first time seeing my mother in 4.5 years, and I would definitely want my husband to be there with me, which probably means Ella too, since it's halfway across the country. But I have maintained a warm relationship with my own grandmother and the rest of my family over the years, so I would be very sad not to go. Also, for context, my parents divorced when I was a kid, and they do not communicate. I have a great relationship with my dad, and so does Ella, but he's pretty much entirely removed from the situation with my mom. What would you do?
All right, so Catherine, I know this is a tough one, but you're a guest, and I believe guests should go first, and you also have a child that's young, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are when you hear this. Like, what would you do?
Well, there's so many layers to this question, so I'm going to just pull out a couple of salient thoughts. So first, I don't think at this point you're inherently denying your child an amazing experience by not introducing her to her grandmother. I think it sounds like she has really warm and loving grandparents, and so she's not missing out on the grandparent experience. That said, I do think that there are situations where having a grandchild can sort of change the dynamics between a grown child and their parent, and that there's potentially an opportunity to sort of be able to come together over the child in a new way that wouldn't have been possible before that child was born. But again, not fully knowing all aspects of the situation, it sounds like the relationship you've really judged to be harmful to you in the past. And so I think you shouldn't sort of force yourself back into it on your daughter's behalf, but perhaps be open to the idea of, you know, that there could be ways to come together in the future. That's a sort of macro thing. I think specifically about the funeral, my thought is that bringing a four-year-old to an actual funeral ceremony and letting that be the time that she meets her grandma for the first time would not be ideal. If you do end up going, which it sounds like you really want to do, and bringing your daughter along, like, definitely I would recommend shielding her from that initial experience. And perhaps if you feel comfortable, you know, deciding if you want your mother to meet her another day in another kind of much calmer environment. But that highly charged emotional environment of a funeral or a wake does not seem like an ideal time to introduce your mother and your daughter.
Hmm. Carva, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much my answer note for note. I mean, this is really hard. And I think one of the things that always occurs to me when people say, you know, I've this relationship has been ended for reasons that are general and vague, and it's unclear what those reasons are, but that the person has, like Catherine said, kind of judged the relationship to be toxic. I think so much of the what to do does depend on some level of knowing exactly what that means, because sometimes we have relationships that are difficult and painful for us and also reconcilable. Right. And sometimes we have relationships that are difficult and abusive and painful for us and are not reconcilable and should never be attempted to reconcile. And it's I don't think that everything falls into that second category, but I think you kind of have to know what the details are. So just that having been said, let's assume that this person, that this is a relationship that where reconciliation is not the main goal. And so it's a question of how do I proceed as a parent knowing that I have this unreconcilable relationship with my mother? And I think the same thing, like kids don't need a billion grandparents, you know? Mm. They like that. I mean, it's I don't think you have to have that. My kids have sort of, you know, like our grandparent situation is wonky in a variety of ways. And I think even having, it's great if you can have one grandparent, but if that grandparent is good and fun and brings happiness and joy to the life of the kid, then it's a wonderful thing. But if the relationship with that grandparent is toxic and damaging and difficult, it's not worth it, and it's not mandatory, and especially in the case that you describe where there already are loving grandparents. I also agree that a funeral, I wouldn't take a four-year-old to a funeral anyway. I mean, I'm sure there are some instances in which I might, but I would look very hard to see if there's a way I could not bring a four-year-old to a funeral.
Yeah.
And her, so I think daughter is just two, actually. She's not four.
Sorry.
She's two.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's okay. She said 4.5 years, which is why I think the four-year-old
Because she hadn't talked to her mom for 4.5 years. Oh,
right.
Two.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Definitely
yeah.
Do not bring your two-year-old to the funeral.
Yeah, you can easily not bring a two-year-old to a funeral. And it doesn't. In some ways, I would probably bring a two-year-old more than I'd bring a four-year-old, because a four-year-old is going to have more questions. I think a two-year-old is going to be a little bit more of toddler arm candy that just makes people laugh. But that aside, I wouldn't bring a kid to a funeral anyway under most circumstances. And so that clears the question of how to deal with that. And if you were to somehow do that for some reason, which I don't, you know, you could decide that. I also agree that that would be a pretty charged and difficult environment to also introduce this other person. And so, you know, when I think ahead, I think that, of course, a kid is going to ask ultimately, hey, like, what's the deal with your mom? Do you ever talk to her? Like, why haven't I ever met your mom, kind of thing? And if I were in your situation as a parent, one thing I'd be afraid of, I'd be afraid to, depending on the variety of circumstances, but there'd be a part of me that was afraid of saying that I am sort of estranged from my mom and explaining what that is to my, let's say, 6-year-old or 8-year-old or whenever the kid asks this. Because I'd be afraid of introducing that idea to them, that we might be estranged sometime. And in some ways, that would be the biggest emotional fear underneath all this for me. And I would want to hear, the thing I would want to hear if I was in that situation is like a real distinction between the reason I'm not talking with my mother is because she is toxic and damaging. And I am not toxic and damaging to my kids. And I hope I never am. And so I sense that there's some possible guilt on the part of this letter writer about their part in the fact that the relationship has fallen to distance. And I would, if I were in that situation, I would want someone to remind me, it's okay. It's not your fault. You don't have to feel guilty about it, and you don't have to hide the fact of it. And your child will ask about it when they're ready to ask about it. And then when they're ready to ask about it, if I were in your situation, I would explain it as clearly and directly as I can. I don't have a relationship with her. We had a difficult time. I found her to be hurtful. She was a person who was in a lot of pain, and sometimes she caused that pain to other people, and I didn't want that. And I try to be a better mother. And I love you very much. Something like that, which is the kind of thing I've actually had to say to my kids around some things, too. So, yeah, it's a tough situation.
It is. And the situation really resonates with me. I really wanted to hear what both of you had to say first, because I am in this exact situation. I don't really have a relationship with my father. He and my mother are divorced. They were divorced when I was little. And it's always been very hard to navigate that with my two kids when they were younger. I tried to reestablish a relationship with my dad because I had this same feeling, and I got a lot of pressure from him and just from other people in my family that, like, I would be somehow denying my kids a relationship with a grandparent. So, you know, I tried. It didn't really work out for me. It made me really unhappy and put me in a very bad place. Then I got divorced, and then the easy out for a few years was that my dad had a polite relationship with my ex. So he would arrange visits with the kids and stuff, and to take the kids to movies and stuff with my ex and not with me. And so that was kind of like a peaceable kind of in-between situation. But now the kids are a little bit older, and frankly, I've been really transparent with them about, you know, kind of my relationship with my dad, why it is the way it is. They get it. And they now make the choice. I mean, they have a cordial relationship with him. If he wants to take them to play golf or something, like, they'll go. But they don't think it's weird. They have lots of other grandparents with whom me, their dad, their stepdad have good relationships. So they get to see a lot of positive interaction with grandparents. I don't think they feel deprived. And I also pick up what you picked up, Carvel, is that there's some guilt here. I do think there is in the culture a sense that grandparents have a right to grandchildren. And frankly, I don't think that's the case. And in my lifetime, in my experience, in my life, I have worked really hard to get over that pressure of grandparents having a right to be a part of everything. If they were bad parents, they don't have that right. And if they create situations that are toxic, and if you worry that they are going to put your kids in a situation where they're going to let your kids down in some way, it is absolutely a parenting decision you get to make to keep that wall up on their behalf. And when they get a little bit older and you can be more transparent, talk about it then. So I agree with what both of you had to say. And as someone in this situation, I would just say it is your right to keep that wall up. So it is hard, though. It's really, really hard. And this was a tough question, and I really appreciate the fact that it was asked, because it's something that we haven't talked about on the show, I don't think, before, right?
We have not.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
All right, our next question comes in the form of a voicemail from a listener, so let's listen to that.
Hi, my name is Sejal, and I had a question for Slate's Mom and Dad Are Fighting podcast. My 4-year-old daughter is great at following rules and instructions, but I'm concerned that she's too dependent on them. For example, she insists on copying the picture on the box of Lego sets, or once when playing with Clay, she insisted I play too, and then she copied the butterfly I made. And another time, after I left her design your own puzzle to do with her grandparents, I returned to see that she'd drawn a tractor, just like the one that was on the package. I always encourage her to do whatever she wants instead of copying, and I praise her creations no matter what. But I'm concerned because I was the exact same way as her when I was a child. And although I'm very happy with my career as a physician, it's one where I could work very hard, learn lots of stuff, and then apply that knowledge, rather than one where I direct my every move. I fear that if my daughter continues to rely on directions and following the rules, she's going to be limiting her life and career options and won't be able to pursue more self-directed careers, such as being an artist, a media mogul, an entrepreneur, a journalist. She's only 4, so I know I have time to nip this problem in the bud, but I have no idea how. My husband insists this trait is inherited in her DNA and that we can do nothing about it. As podcasters and journalists, you all have the self-direction that I wish to install in her, so I'd love to hear your insight into how I could help her. Thank you so much. Love the podcast.
All right. Carvel, do you want to tackle this one first?
Yeah. I mean, I relate to this question a lot, actually, because I think that there is, and I've talked about this before in the show, I think that there is this feeling when our kids are very young that their entire future depends 100% on our input. You know, that like we have to navigate in these very particular ways. Otherwise, this other terrible thing will or will not happen in 30 plus years. And I think as parents of, you know, young toddler, preschool age kids, whatever, we overestimate the extent to which we can navigate around future, around things that may or may not take place in 30 years down the road. I don't think that the daughter copying things and playing by the rules in any way means anything about anything that will happen career-wise for this person. I just really don't. I know that I myself, it's funny that she used us as an example. I am someone who has, I mean, I've worked straight office jobs for many decades, and I've always hated having a boss, and I've always been someone who's like done his own thing, and now I do my own thing, and blah, blah, blah. But I also know that when I was a kid, I was tremendously risk averse. I mean, I was terribly risk averse. Other kids would make fun of me. They'd be like, let's go do this thing. I'd be like, guys, is this safe? You know, it's like, I was just that kid, you know? But it turns out that I found the way in which I'm not risk averse. I'm not risk averse in my work, in my writing, and in the way that I go about doing my thing in the world. I just had to find my thing that I was driven and passionate enough about that I didn't even see as a risk where other people saw risk. And so that's how I got here. It was not because anyone encouraged me to color outside the lines or anything like that, because I was afraid to color outside the lines because I always wanted to please everyone all the time when I was a kid. That was a really big part of my growing up. So I just use my own example as a way of saying, there are so many factors that are going to come into the hopper between now and the time your kid's career comes to pass, that whether or not they copy the tractor on the box or they make something different, I don't think is as big a thing as you think. My advice to most parents of young kids is relax. You know, like in general, that's, and I wish someone had told me that, because being a parent of a young child is so stressful. And I wish someone had told me, you don't have to stress nearly as much as you think you do, because I could have used the sleep, you know. And so I guess that's the main thing I say. And the other thing I guess is like, it feels like you're seeing something in your daughter that you think is a reflection of you, and that you're uncomfortable with about yourself, which is something I totally relate to. One of my favorite quotes about parenting ever was from my kid's mom, Jo, who said that having kids is like having your character defects grow legs and run around outside of you. and that has been my experience. That is one of the most terrifying things about having kids, is watching them do all the things and be all the things that you secretly hate about yourself, because you've passed it on to them. You just have. And that's just the way it is. You hand off the baton to them. You're like, maybe you'll deal with this better than I do. Good luck. Go get them, you know? And oftentimes they do, and sometimes they don't. But either way, it's out of our hands. Your daughter sounds like a lovely person. Sounds like she's going to be great. Sounds like she's a great, caring, loving mom. I would just get off her back, let her do what she's going to do. One day she'll color outside the lines when she wants to. One day she won't.
Or she won't.
She's good. Or she won't. You know, she's good. She's really good.
Yeah, she's actually so reminiscent of what my stepdaughter was like when she was little. And I remember, and I don't know if that's what this mom is feeling sometimes, but I remember just feeling like it was really boring. Like, why are you just like not able to like do anything different than what it is you're being presented? And I had really like concerns that, does she have no imagination? You know, what's the matter? And you know what? Turns out the same traits that you're looking and worried about, like, actually end up making you really successful in school, because kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade and fourth grade especially are all about, here are the directions, please follow them. And as a result, she was always really sort of successful in all of these structured things that are very hard for a lot of kids. We never had to worry about any of that. And it's just, Carvel said, like all the creative stuff, like it just kicks in. It just starts happening, just like it happened with you. I mean, you turned into a physician, listener. So I'm guessing you were probably also successful in school, and now you love to learn new things. So yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about this either. I would let her be a direction follower, because someday she won't be, and you will be missing the time where she was.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There is going to be one night. I used to, when my daughter wouldn't sleep, Georgia was a terrible sleeper, and she would be up at 3 a.m. and it would drive me crazy. And the only thing I would use to comfort me at my darkest moments was, there's going to be a time when she's 15 or 16, and I'm going to wish that I knew where she was at 3 a.m.
Right.
And that when you have teenagers, this kid will find new and endless ways to not follow directions, and you're going to pray for the days when she followed directions, I assure you.
What do you think, Catherine? Do you agree?
I agree with what was said. And I also just want to add, I think that this question is much more about the mother's anxiety about her identity than it is about the child. And I think she, you know, again, she said in the call, she's a physician. She has had success in her life. And, you know, I think a lot of the, and so perhaps there's some unresolved feelings about her life choices, even though she's been really successful. But I think that the idea here is that there are certain traits that are, do seem to be inherited, and this could potentially be one of them. And I think Rebecca and Carvel are right with the school stuff. Like, this kid's going to get a ton of positive reinforcement for this behavior in school, and it's going to really help them feel confident in themselves academically. And as they develop their other interests, like having that as a base and doing well academically can be really open doors for them in other ways. So I think mm-hmm. that there's really not a lot to worry about here. And I think the listener should just feel comfortable that everything is going fine, and that the daughter, I think, will come into her own in various ways and may end up being just like her. And that's actually just fine.
Yeah, especially if you're a doctor. It's yeah. fine. All right. Well, thank you very much for leaving that voicemail. And we love getting questions by voicemail. We love hearing listeners' voices on the show. And if you want to add your voice, you can call the show at 424-255-7833.
Hey, Karen Feeding listeners. It's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambie Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some consider taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out the recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, now it's time for recommendations. Catherine, what have you got for us?
Okay, so my recommendation is really more aimed at the mom listeners of Mom and Dad Are Fighting, which I will explain why in a minute. My recommendation is to take yourself out to bars by yourself. So
amen.
So a week or two ago, I was gonna have this big professional day. I had a big cover story coming out, and I was super excited, and my son got sick, so I ended up spending like the whole day with him next to me on the couch, sort of frantically trying to do my work while he was sick. And and this was a day that I was like really jazzed about. And then at the end, and I basically had to stay in the house the whole day. It was like super claustrophobic. And I like felt really good. I wanted to celebrate, but then it's like, it was like a Tuesday. It was a weekday. I texted a friend or two who like couldn't drop everything with 10 minutes notice and go out to have a drink with me. So I was just like, you know what? I'm going to go out to a bar by myself. So my husband got home. I was like, okay, great. You take over. I went to a bar down the street, ordered myself a Negroni, had read on my Kindle, like eavesdropped on people who are on dates, and it was totally awesome. And the thing is that I would not have gone out to bars by myself in my 20s because, one, I think I would have felt like a loser, and two, I would have felt uncomfortable as a woman going out to bars at that age, that I was just like asking for men to come talk to me. But a certain kind, I mean, obviously this is not going to work at every type of bar, but in the certain kinds of hipster cocktail bars that are in Brooklyn, a woman going out alone with a book is apparently not like a complete oddity, and people did not act like I had 12 heads, and no one bothered me, and it was fine, and it was totally awesome, and I felt like I got like a special celebratory moment, and I didn't feel like a loser just because my friends couldn't drop everything and meet me. And then when I came home, it turned out my son had a huge potty accident. My husband had to clean everything up and he was in bed. And so I missed all that after spending all day with him. And I was just like, wow.
Double bonus.
I was like, everybody. So like, I think it can be really hard when you have little kids to relax at home, even if the kids aren't there. There's just like so much mess. There's so much going on. So get yourself out of the house. Take yourself out to a nice hipster cocktail bar. bring your book. That's my recommendations for the moms of the world.
No, that's a good one. I really like it. And I like what you had to say about there is something about when you become a parent, like that whole being in a bar alone thing just feels completely different. It doesn't feel weird. It doesn't feel like you used to look at people and think like, why is she here alone? It doesn't feel that way at all because you just don't care anymore. You're just happy to be not be home dealing with poo or whatever you're dealing with, right?
Exactly. and the reason I aimed it at moms is that I think that men in general are like – are historically more comfortable going to bars alone. Like, I think, like, sports bars, there's a much bigger culture. That's why I don't think, like, dads inherently need this recommendation, although I'm sure dads can benefit from this. But I just want to encourage moms to just go for it because I was a little hesitant at first that I would feel like a big weirdo, but whatever. Who cares what anyone thinks? Just go out, have a Negroni.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to second that because when you said, you know, I feel like it's okay to do it and people aren't going to look at me like I have 12 heads. I literally found myself thinking, why would anyone look at her like she had 12 heads? Like, I don't even get that. And then I was like, oh, I don't get that because I'm a guy. So when I go to a bar alone, I was like, oh, like it just dawned on me. So yeah, guys, dads do not need the reminder. In fact, dads could probably stand to be reminded, hey, stop going to bars without your family. Go home and take care of your kids, my man.
That's dads, maybe send, the advice. Send your wife to a bar. Give her
Dad,
her Kindle.
Send your wife to a bar. Yeah.
Get home early so your wife can hit the happy hours.
There you go.
Well, my recommendation is an article that was sent to me. My day job, I'm a digital director at a news outlet and always looking for cool ways that people do news stories using digital tools. And this one was sent to me and it ended up also being a parenting story. And I love both the story and the digital treatment. And this is why I'm recommending it. This is from the California Sunday Magazine. There's a story called Raising a Teenage Daughter by Elizabeth Weil, asterisks with comments and corrections by Hannah W. Duane, photography by Tabitha Soren. So Hannah W. Duane is Elizabeth Weil's 15-year-old daughter. And in this essay, it's written in the first person by Elizabeth, but then there are these highlighted sections where if you click on the highlighted section, there's a pop-up. And those are the daughter's notes on her mother's essay. And they are moving, interesting, funny, and cool. And it reminds me a lot of, you know, during the primary and then during the presidential race, like NPR had this like real-time fact-checking tool where there's like a highlighted section and you pop it up and there'd be a fact check. They use that same kind of tool except to let a 15-year-old comment on her mother's essay about parenting a 15-year-old. So it's really, really well done. It's a beautifully written piece to begin with, but I think the best part of it is reading the daughter's comments. The same way, very often the best way to learn about how we're doing as parents is to actually listen to our kids giving us feedback about how we're doing as parents. So I think this is a link that I'm going to share with you guys and certainly we'll share it on the Mom and Dad Are Fighting Facebook page. Definitely take a look at it and click on all those highlighted sections. My one little favorite part is she, you know, kind of the daughter sort of breaks in and the mom sort of talks about her teenage tantrums and the daughter has a little comment about like what you call tantrums is just kids venting, get over it, mom, kind of thing. But then there's this one little passage where she talks about, you know, at one point when your kids are little, they're about to run into traffic, you're able to run out and save them and you hit that little highlighted part and the daughter just says, thanks. And it's so sweet. Aww. And it kind of goes on in that vein. It gets snarky. It's moving. It's wonderful. So anyway, I really recommend checking that out. It is amazing and a really great use of digital journalism along the way.
Sounds like a great article.
Love it. Well, my recommendation has to switch up at the last minute because my teenage daughter has failed me. She, after I failed her first, yesterday I was in the car with her and I was like, oh, I got to do recommendations. What are you reading right now? What are you looking at? So she told me about this book that she loved. And then she was like, it's such a great book. And she described it. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to remember this. So I took a picture on my phone of the front and back cover and figured I would like research it and get it all prepped. And then I left my phone. When I came to the studio, I don't have my phone with me. So I texted her while we were doing the show to be like, Georgia, what was that book? I left my phone at home. Can you please tell me the book? And then she texts back a half an hour later, wait, didn't you take a picture of it on your phone? And I'm like, yeah, but I left my phone at home. I'm going on right now. Like right now they're asking. Let me know. And then I haven't heard back from her. So
to be clear, you're texting on your computer, just in case people don't like call
texting,
you out for like
inconsistencies
here. Yes.
Yes, I'm texting from my laptop my daughter, she's not supposed to be texting at school at all. So this is not her fault by any stretch of the imagination.
It's your fault.
It sounds like she's holding you accountable for leaving your phone at home, Carvel.
She really is.
I think you should think about the lesson she's teaching you right now.
Oh, no. And so we've all come full circle. So that having been said, I'm going to recommend a book that I know she loved, and she talks about it all the time. And that book is Wonder. It's a children's novel by an author named R.J. Palacio. And Wonder is a book about a fifth grade boy who suffers from a rare medical facial deformity. And it's written in the first person from, as I recall, it's written in the first person from this person's point of view. And Georgia found that book moving and stunning. She talks about it all the time. She references it. I think it had a really huge impact on her understanding of the world, her understanding of narrative and point of view, and her understanding of story and writing. And she's just listed it as one of her favorite books. So I just wanted to recommend that. That's Wonder by R.J. Palacio.
And a movie
Good recommendation.
That just came out too, right?
What?
A movie just came out.
Yeah, with Julia Roberts.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
The biggest movie star in the world, Carvel. Do you live under a rock?
The biggest movie star in the world of 1997. Wait, exactly. I had no idea. Oh, I did not know that. I missed that entire thing. What the heck?
Slate's Luddite mom and dad are fighting.
We'll be sure to brief you on everything happening before the show starts.
Please do. I have no idea.
Okay. We'll be sure to send you the DVD version of that movie with special DVD commentary.
Laserdisc only, please.
I heard the movie was great, too. Yeah.
Good. That's good to know because sometimes they have,
All right. Well, that does it for the show. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is produced by Benjamin Frisch. The homepage for the show is slate.com/momanddad. If you have a question you'd like to ask on the air, leave a message at 424-255-7833. You can also join us on Facebook at facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. And yes, Carvel and Gabe and I do pop in and answer follow-up questions that you have about the show. For Carvel Wallace, Catherine Goldstein, and me, Rebecca Lavoie, we will see you next week. And Gabe, we hope you feel better soon.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.